PNC Bank brings you Call of the Wild Money Moves. You hear that?
YOLO!
That's an internet troll telling you to put all your money into a single investment.
YOLO! YOLO! YOLO!
He wants you to liquidate your emergency fund.
YOLO!
And buy a digital racehorse named Silicon Steve.
YOLO!
Stay vigilant. He's very persistent.
YOLO!
Guard against wild money moves with PNC Bank. Brilliantly boring since 1865.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Blanca Simpson spent the good part of 2 decades working hand-in-hand with Maggie Murdaugh, with Alec Murdaugh, Paul, Buster, the whole family. She was part of their life as the family's housekeeper. She knows that world, that life, better than most. She was right there with them, breathing every breath alongside Maggie and Paul while they were still here with us. She joins us now to give us her exclusive insight into what the retrial of Alec Murdaugh means for all of those in the South Carolina Lowcountry affected by this tragedy. And as we go through this conversation with her, I'd love to get your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Those links are in the description. Let's get into our conversation. The other day, obviously, the big news comes down. The Supreme Court overturns the verdict. All 5 justices, unanimous. I mean, we know this had been simmering for a bit. We thought, you know, this very likely could happen. But when it actually did happen, when the news came out, how did it hit you? What was your reaction initially?
You know, I thought I had prepared myself for it. And I thought I would be okay with whatever verdict they came up with, whatever their decision that they made. Mm-hmm. But in actuality, once the verdict came out, it felt like a punch in the gut, to tell you the truth. It really took me for a, you know, I knew it was coming and I could understand, you know, and I respect the court's decision, but still, you know, it still hits hard. It really does. 'Cause here we go again. And, yeah, you know, people starting to get back to normal and now here we go again.
I mean, a lot of things I'm sure run through your mind. What did you do? What was your reaction to that? I mean, did you sometimes, you know, like you get weird news sometimes and it's like, I just want to go to bed. I want to go put the sheets over my head and be like, okay, I need a couple minutes to process this or days or whatever. What did you do when with that information, when you got it, how did you start to try to work through it?
I told my husband I was going to the store to get something for dinner.
Yeah.
And I went to the cemetery. I felt that I had to go to the cemetery. And I can't explain it. I don't know. It's almost like I could hear her say, girl, you know, you got to come and see me. You know, that sort of thing. It was just a feeling that I had. I had that urge to go to the cemetery. And I mean, I know they can't hear me. I know they can't, you know, I can't see them, but it was just something that I felt I had to do, was let them know, hey, here we go again.
Did you know you were going to the cemetery when you got in that car, or when you turned the ignition and you started going? Was it initially to the store and then you just like, no, we're going to the cemetery?
That was an excuse that I used. I mean, I still had to go to the store, but my intention, as soon as I heard the news, it was, I don't know, it was just an overwhelming feeling that I had to go there.
When you got to the cemetery, walk us through what happened there. What was it like for you?
And I know people are going to say, well, she was probably doing, it wasn't anything that you do for show. I recorded it because I wanted people to understand that it is a, you know, it's a bad experience when you go through something like this. You think everything's been resolved. He's in prison. And then all of a sudden you hear the news that he was basically, it's a technicality, you know, and, my voice was really shaky because, like I said, I thought I was prepared, but I really was not prepared for those, you know, the news.
I Fran, your co-author on the book, had told me that you had gone out there and that you made a short video. I have not watched it. Did you say anything to Maggie and Paul when you were at the grave that day?
I think it was something to the effect of, you know, something about people can go on with their life, but here we go again, or you know, but the only two that can't speak are right here. They can't speak for themselves are right here. And something to that effect.
Yeah.
And then I said, all because of a technicality. And it's hurtful. It's really, really hurtful. You know, people have gone on. Maybe people mourn other people different. Maybe I don't know if it's a culture thing, but I was very loyal to her, and you know, it hurts. It really hurts that because somebody wanted a shot at stardom, you know, that here we go again, you know, all over again.
I mean, you got to have a lot of emotions and feelings about that, because I mean, it is a technicality. And you know, people will go into the trial and go, well, the financial this, and I mean, we can talk about that too, but had this not happened, the odds of us getting here, and when I say this, I mean Becky Hill and her tampering with the jurors, had that not happened, the odds would have been significantly lower of this getting a shot at a retrial. Of course, Alec would have tried no matter what, but this seems to be what the big tipping point was, with the financial crimes sprinkled on top as here's a little even more reason why. When you think about this and you think about Becky Hill and the way that she had handled all of this, I had just watched one of the Murdaugh docs again the other day, and she was in part two of it talking about her duties and, you know, very, very proud of how she handled it. This was before all the charges came down. But when you see how Becky carried herself, a lot of pride in her position, but you know now behind the scenes what was going on. I mean, what are you saying to Becky Hill in your mind in those moments?
I really can't say that.
If we had to use a bleep button. I mean, how would you describe it appropriate? I mean, if you could, like what's going through your mind when you think of that? I mean, there's got to be moments of anger there, or what?
You know, my main focus is with folks that get into positions, especially in the area that we're from. It's small communities all together.
Yeah.
And some people get in positions of power, and instead of using them for good, you know, it's more about them than about why you got that position, you know. And that's my issue, is when you get in a position, or when you promise you're going to do something, you know, for the people, do it for the people, not because of you trying to get something out of it. Mm-hmm. It's I don't know. You have to have some kind of values and morals with that. And it really does upset me that, you know, some people get certain positions and abuse those positions because of the status that they carry. I don't know if I make sense, you know. And I mean, lately you see a lot of that in the news. It's like you get elected to a position, you get selected for a position, you go and you work in a certain position, and it kind of makes you feel like you're above the law or you're above everybody and you can do as you please. Well, perhaps, but she should have measured the enormous amount of publicity that this case was getting, and that there was the possibility of no chance. She should have never thought that she was above, you know, the law or above anything else. She should have done her job the way she should have done, you know, she should have performed her job. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, the glamour, the celebrity, the Hollywood lights, you know, New York, whatever, you know, everything was focused around her. And the documentary that you're talking about, I was shocked when I saw her basically almost narrating.
Yeah.
And it that stung when I saw her doing that, because mm-hmm. I was not aware that she was going to be a part of it. Yeah. And most certainly not, you know, narrating or, you know, basically that's what it looked like.
Yeah.
And I tell people all the time, you know, you can, you know, people, I've had some people that have said, you know, well, she's lying and I'm going to make her tell the truth and some stuff like that. But it's like, okay, you know, I told my truth. I said the truth. It does. Some people are going to believe it. Some people are not going to believe it. But what I want to know is, why are you so determined to prove me wrong or to say that I'm saying something that is incorrect? What bed were you hiding under, or what closet were you in for the last 15 years that you know more about the inside works of that family than me? I just want to know which bedroom, under what bed, and in what closet were you hiding, that you can tell me more about this family just by what you've seen and observed. I mean, you can have brothers and sisters that you grew up with, but once you get married and you have your lives apart, you don't tell everybody what goes on within your house. It's kind of like the family kind of separate. You do things together or whatever, but they don't know your odds and ends in the house. Mm-hmm. And people, for some reason, some people don't understand that. You know, when you're around people on the weekends, you have your guard up at times. I know she did. She used mm-hmm. to tell me that all the time. She couldn't be herself. So, yeah, it is. It's been upsetting, but I think this time around, I'm better prepared because of basically talking to you guys. You know, the way you guys ask me questions and all that. I think I'm more prepared this time than I was the last time. The last time, I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
At least I know what to expect now.
Do you think, and this is obviously just pure conjecture and just opinion, do you think Becky Hill, that attitude, that way of thinking, that was she a systemic of a bigger problem in that courthouse? Was there a lot of people in that courthouse, in your opinion, that kind of had their own agenda, not necessarily for fame or fortune or selling a book, but here's how we're going to do things. Yeah, there's rules, but here's how we do things here. And just, I'm really wondering how much Becky realized that she was putting her weight on the scale of justice here, or putting her thumbprint on it, or if she just thought she was being folksy. You know, and just, well, you better look out for what he's saying. Just this people that make comments, which is fine at the coffee shop, not when you're overseeing the jury. But exactly. Sometimes people get into those positions of power and then those lines really blur, and they still try to be the folksy coffee shop version of themselves in places where there's reasons you can't do that. It's a legal setup. When you run that through your mind and your opinion, where do you think Becky was on that? Do you think obviously she didn't want her to go this far and have her life destroyed the way she's destroyed it. But I do wonder, was she, in her mind, just being herself? And I'm wondering what she's telling herself today as she sits on her swing in her front yard as people take pictures of her. I just saw some of those. How far do you think this was going to go in the mind of Becky Hill when she was talking to that jury originally?
I believe she was in the mentality that it was okay, you know, because that's how she is. That's her personality.
Yeah.
I don't think she measured the effect that it was going to have on the case. Mm-hmm. And I just don't believe that she actually, you know, thought it through. And those are positions when I was in the military, I had a top secret clearance for one of the positions that I held. And you just have to learn that certain things you do not discuss. If you want to be a friend of mine or you want to be friendly with me, that's fine. But we don't discuss my job, especially in the position that I was in.
Yeah.
And that's basically how I view it. And that's one of the reasons I'm really passionate about people who get into certain positions. Do your job. Do it for the people that you work for. Don't do it for your glory or your you know, for any kind of gain. You're there to serve a purpose. And in her situation, I think it went above that.
Yeah.
It went way above her head. And, you know, unfortunately, here we are again.
Yeah.
I mean, she was really good. She was very friendly to everybody. And,
yeah,
and I mean, people are now kicking themselves in the buffer.
Yeah, I get how, I mean, she comes across, if you didn't know her and she didn't, you'd be like, oh, she's, you know, this, you know, kind of bubbly lady, you know, and if she just stuck to doing her job, everything would have been fine. But yes. Obviously, that's not what happened. Obviously, here we're looking at another trial that's going to be coming up. You're likely going to be called as a witness here. When you look at yourself today, and then you look back 3 years ago as to who you were on that witness stand, how have you changed? Are you the same witness you were 3 years ago? Will you be the same person going into court again when this next trial comes up, if you're called?
My story's not going to change.
No,
what I said, and I meant what I said.
No.
You know, regardless, I think I've grown a lot in the aspect that I'm very nitpicky, or, you know, I kind of pick and choose. I can see people sometimes that are don't mean me any good, mm-hmm. you know, that and I've made some really good. I've also met some really good people that have helped me along the way to that are in the business that have guided me along. To help me so that I don't stumble. And I'm very appreciative of that. Because I never asked to be put in this position.
No.
I was not expecting I was not expecting all of this, from simply testifying. I had no idea what I was going to be asked. They had questioned me, and I had no idea. I had no idea. They told me 15 minutes on the stand. That was the most I was going to be on there. And then you're on your way. You know, you can go live your life. You know how they put it.
Mm-hmm.
And when it started going on and on and on, and then the jury going in and out and, you know, people throwing papers across the floor and all that, I didn't know what to expect.
Sure.
You know, other than I came home and I'm telling you, I went to Walmart thinking that I can pick up the groceries real quick and then head on home. Everybody's probably at work, so they're not watching me. I forgot that people watch the thing on their phone.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But it's been a roller coaster of emotions. But I think this time around, my story is not going to change.
Sure.
I know what I said, and I know what I saw within that house. I saw them. I saw them for who they were and how they interacted, the type of family that they were.
You spent 3 hours testifying during the first trial, talking about all different elements of that life, how Maggie folded her pajamas, if she folded her pajamas, where the towels belonged, what was moved, missing, or wrong the morning after. And we can go into some of that again in a little bit. When you and in no way would I think you'd change your story or anything like that, but if you're to look at this beyond just your own experiences, in round two, when the prosecution will be asking questions of yourself and others, are there any questions that you look at now and go, I wish they would have asked that the first time, either so you could clarify something or share something that maybe you didn't share, or that others that have information that would have been helpful for a jury to consider, or for people to understand the dynamics of everything that was going on here, the way you see it?
The first thing was to explain the fact that the first time that I heard the kennel video, it was on a laptop, and the speaker system was not that great. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were saying that I kind of contradicted myself. It was not a contradiction. Actually, the way that it was echoing when I was listening to it, it was not that the sound system was horrible on it.
Sure.
So that's one of the reasons, you know, that once I heard it and I saw, you know, the image, I told them right away who it was, Maggie, Paul, and Alex. Mm-hmm. But the original time, the first time that I heard it, it was on I don't know if it had been dropped too many times or what, but that laptop had a really bad sound system, audio. I couldn't hear it that well. I actually recorded something on my laptop the other day to try to get some information out, and it was the worst recording I have ever. It reminded me of that recording because It was like I could not get the sound to, and I was speaking into it. Yeah. And it was just horrible. And it took me back to that day when I heard it. And I was like, it's almost like you blame yourself. It's like, why couldn't I describe it? Why couldn't I say that?
But walk me back. Because I don't think I know. When was the first time you saw the video on the bad speaker laptop? Was that in court? Or where was the first time you had that experience?
I heard the audio. They never showed me a video.
Okay, so you heard the audio. Was that during the trial itself?
No, I heard it. They brought it here prior to the trial.
Okay.
They came to my house and they wanted me to hear the audio, but the audio was horrible on that laptop.
Yeah.
And
so you
I didn't
want to,
even though people said I contradicted.
So you heard it at home. When you did have the realization and you had clear audio to make an accurate judgment call on what you were taking in, and you realized it was Alec right there on that tape, and the timing, from what we understand, if the prosecution is correct, you know, puts him right there. It, more than anything else, totally contradicts his original story. And this was obviously before Alec went on the stand and said, I was lying about my story. When you first had that realization, number one, did you think he had done it at that time, or did that seal the deal for you in your mind that this man, either he did it or he had something seriously to do with it, because that put him there and that was not what he was saying? What was going through your mind when you could confirm to yourself, Alex's story is not adding up?
When I saw the towel, that glimpse of the towel in his Suburban.
What was the towel in the Suburban for you?
When they released that video, that body cam video, but prior to that, I was still kind of like on the fence, hoping and, you know, praying that it wasn't him, you know? And when they released the body cam video, that Officer Green that night was wearing, the first officer that responded to the call. Mm-hmm. When I saw the towel, because of the fact that the pajamas were laid out in the middle of the doorway. Mm-hmm. And I told him at that point, I knew that it was just something about the towel that was taken off of the top of the shelf in the laundry room. And then somebody laying out her, you know, the pajamas, you know, laying flat in the middle of the doorway with a clean pair of underwear, knowing that, you know, trying to throw, I guess to me, that was like trying to throw somebody off. Like she changed in a hurry to go check on Paul or something, you know, or she must've heard something. Cause they did ask me about, can you hear noises from the kennel inside the house? They did ask me that question several times when they talked to me, you know, here and there. But you really couldn't hear anything. That house was solid.
Yeah.
If you were on the inside, unless the gunshots came right there, you could not hear it in the house.
Sure.
I just could not believe that story, you know, that he was, the first story that he was telling, it just did not make sense to me that he laid down and he didn't hear and then from the shock, I think it angered me more when I found out about him leaving them out there after they were killed. You know, he left them almost an hour before he called.
And then it makes you wonder, okay, so if he did this and he killed them and he went back to the house, he would have had to have the mindset to, if he's the one who did lay the stuff out, the pajamas, the underwear, I mean, stuff that Maggie wouldn't do, but Alec or whoever laid it out somehow thought, oh, this will throw people off. This will show that she was here and she was getting ready for bed, even though it's things she doesn't do. That's an interesting one in itself too. But I, you know, the way we've seen Alec compartmentalize things, it's not a bridge too far to go down. Do you think Alec is the one who did those steps of laying that stuff out, the things that were, you know, the towel that was very much a tell to you of what was going on? I know you had mentioned last time we had talked that maybe there was some fixers or people of that nature here. Where's your mind on that today, now that you've had more time to kind of to simmer with this?
You know, I have a problem with the fact that people are still questioning when he left the house that he was speeding or whatever. That's nothing. There is nothing unusual about that. That sure. Man would floor it. It didn't matter. It was morning, noon, night. Mm-hmm. But you're going to slow down where they found her phone? Explain that to me. Because that just tells me guilty all the way. You slow down where your wife's phone was found. According to the data. The other thing was, why did you have the water hose running? What for? What was the purpose of it? You know, you could hear it in the kennel video and all that. Those are questions that I have. Another thing is, the 400, 500 steps that he took, all of a sudden, you know, he had this spur of energy that they even said that during the trial, you know, did you all of a sudden have this spur of energy to do jumping jacks or whatever, you know? That's where I'm talking about. He must have been running back and forth like a crazy person in the house. As far as the cleaners, I believe after, I believe that they came in after. I do not believe that he had help with the actual murders.
No,
I do not.
You were called in, you know, the next day as the investigation is going on. Alec says, you know, I want you to clean the way Maggie cleaned the house. You know, we got company, we got guests and such coming in. I know I'm paraphrasing. Obviously, this was just a scene of a murder. Is there, I mean, there's so much to process at that moment in time, and I'm sure your mind is. You know, you're wanting to be there for the people you care about. In that moment, you've got to be thinking, you know, my God, everybody's mourning. How can I help? What can I do? But when you had to clean the house or clean the way Maggie did, are you in any way, shape, or form thinking, am I cleaning up a crime scene or things that maybe Alec did that would point in a certain way or direction, or retrospectively looking at it? Do you think that you ended up cleaning any of Alex's mess in that house? And obviously nothing that would be obvious, like blood, but just, you know, his prints on things, the thing, whatever he did in that house in between, were you inadvertently, you know, doing some of his dirty work for him when you thought you were just trying to help the family out at those moments?
To tell you the truth, I was more concerned that her mother was coming, and her mother had to have surgery.
Yeah.
And I wanted to make things as comfortable for her family as I possibly could. And I didn't want them to see Maggie's clothes, you know, in disarray. And I didn't want people to talk about, you know, she left a little pile of clothes or whatever, saying anything bad about her at all or Paul. And so, you know, it, in the back of my mind, when I pulled up, you know, when I first pulled up that morning to the house, you know, I looked around and, like I said, there was no, you could see tire tracks, but you could tell they were old. They were not fresh. I had a habit of doing that because I knew who was there and who had left, you know, based on where they parked in the mornings when I used to pull up. But there was a deputy car out there. And nobody stopped me. Nobody said, no, you can't go in there. Nobody said, this is a crime scene. Nobody told me anything when I first got there. Nobody said anything to me.
When you look back on that, are you surprised they didn't have that whole thing locked down as a crime scene? I mean, theoretically, looking back, the whole damn thing should have been locked down and nobody should have been coming and going. It shouldn't have been a staging error. It should have been investigators, period, at that moment. But meanwhile, you know, it's almost like, you know, getting ready for a family get together. You know, it's kind of shocking just how fast all of that was moving. If you're Alec Murdaugh and you're trying to cover up for a murder, you're going to want as many people in there contaminating that scene as quickly as you can. If you're an investigator, you don't want it. But it seems no investigator had the forethought to say, no more people. We're not cleaning anything up here. How do you process that when you look back on how poorly of an investigation it was in the moments leading after the actual murders?
The way I see it, that was my first lesson in Power Privilege 101.
Yeah.
It was, if you would have been standing there, you would have probably been saying, well, wait a minute, you know, why not the house? And, you know, why the kennels? And I think there was so many people trying to solve it within the first 24, 48 hours that you know, they were the adrenaline. They had all that adrenaline going because of who he was, you know, who his family is. And the two people that were murdered, of course, you know, being Murdaughs themselves. And I think everybody had a habit of catering to that, to them, you know, and wanted to make it as easy going, as easy process. Which, you know, makes sense
that does and it doesn't to me. Because when you look at it and you go, okay, if we're going into this and we're assuming it's not Alec Murdaugh and somebody else did this, and you're wanting to solve the crime for this prominent family that has all this power, I would think you'd be taking such care with that crime scene to make sure nothing is contaminated. It only makes more sense that you'd be contaminating the scene if you're trying to cover up for whoever did it or introduce contaminants that are going to make it impossible to figure out who did it. If you still don't know who it is, I don't know why there's this level of carelessness to this crime scene. That's what doesn't add up to me in terms of the investigation and the officers there and the SLED officers that had been there. If you're doing the power and the privilege of this family and you're exercising that power and privilege and we're really going to get who got this caught, why such a sloppy investigation?
I don't think they believed it was him at first.
No, I don't think so either. That argues my point, though, even further.
And I think, you know, they were just being very polite or very, I'm trying to find the word that I think.
Sure. It's, I get what you're saying. It's almost like it was
for some
not
reason,
intentional.
They were trying to give him more.
Yeah. They're
well,
trying to give more, but
they knew the family. They knew the power.
Not they were trying to not inconvenience them. Yeah, they didn't want to but it's like at that moment in time, it's not about inconveniencing. It's about solving. And it seems like that might have been a gray line. And maybe there's, you know, inexperience that then comes along with that with certain officers, a lot of people there. You see that in cases all the time where it's people may have the right intent. And I'm not saying that Sled had ill intent. I'm just shocked by some of those steps that were taken or not taken. Cause it just so, and that's going to be an interesting thing that Murdaugh certainly leans on, coming up here in the next trial.
And you know, and I hate to see the fact that, I think it was, you know, there was still some kind of like intimidation going on, you know, because of all the colleagues and stuff that were there, friends of the family and all that that had gathered at the home. But I also believe that he was given courtesies that none of us regular people would be given if, in fact, that would have been on our property. We would have told to leave and you can't come back until we tell you to come back.
Yeah.
And those are things that law enforcement has to work on. But another aspect of it is the fact that what the disrespectful way in which they talk to law enforcement, you know, the attorneys will talk to law enforcement to try to make them look like they don't know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they'll come and use, you know, to gather information to make their cases. And then you turn around and you disparage them on the stage and make them look like they're, you know, that they don't know how to do their job. When in reality, look at how many people were there of power. A lot.
Yeah.
There was a lot of people out there of power. And so how can you tell somebody that's at the bottom of the, you know, totem pole, you're in charge and you're in charge, but yet you have other higher status, you know, people there, it's almost like you're trying, you know, it's intimidation to some extent.
Yeah.
But what I don't agree with is these guys go out of their way to help them, you know, as the attorneys to make their cases. And then you turn around and get them on the stand and you make them feel like they're idiots and they're not.
Yeah.
They're professional people doing a job, but, you know.
Sure. I mean,
it
seems
hard to watch.
It seems like there was a lot of people in this case that people didn't want to step on the wrong toes. And there's a level to this, just like Becky Hill, where there's a certain agenda each and every person has with it. And some is good and, you know, pure, if you will, trying to get to the bottom of this, trying to get to the truth. And some have more self-serving motives to them, and it's kind of a cornucopia and a mix of everybody, and that's where you get this dynamic that we've learned about now in the last many years. The kennels themselves, the property, the kennels are now gone. Moselle, the house itself, it's been renovated, it's been sold. During the first trial, the jury did get a chance to go out there to the kennels and see the physical crime scene. Obviously, this round, they're not going to get to do that. Maybe there'll be video, maybe there'll be something virtual, I don't know. How much do you think that weighed on the jury in round one, in terms of their guilty verdict of Alec Murdaugh, seeing the crime scene itself, and how do you think this could impact the second trial, where that visit's physically impossible to make?
You know, I was kind of shocked that they went out to the property to begin with, because it had already been abandoned for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
This second time, you know, I think the jurors are going to pay more attention to what the attorneys are saying, you know, how they put out the scenario, because there's nothing there anymore, only pictures. And God only knows how it's going to turn out, because we really don't know. We know what he wants, you know, to be found not guilty. But I don't see why the reason his appeal was, his case was overturned was because of Becky Hill and, mm-hmm. you know, the juror incident. So yeah. It wasn't that the evidence convicted him. So
yeah,
regardless
yeah,
of what people are saying, you know, the evidence is very strong against him. And like I said, these are things you have to explain, you know, that I don't think they explained it enough in any of the videos or any of the shows that they've done. They have never explained, or if you want to be found not guilty, explain to me why you slowed down where your wife's phone was found. Explain to me why you ran around 500 steps, you know, automatically you got a burst of energy in the house. You know, explain to me why you had all of them people come in your house knowing that it was part of a crime. He knew what he was doing, you know, and was it convenient for him? And then I felt like I was used, you know, to some extent, where everything was going to be deflected on me, saying, well, she cleaned up the evidence, you know. No, don't bring that on me. I did my job. I was, I did my job, but I was not responsible for anybody. I was not in a law enforcement capacity. Regardless, I'm not stupid, but I was not in a law enforcement capacity. That was not my job, and it was their job. So don't deflect it on me and make it look like I cleaned up or I did this or I did that. No, law enforcement was there. They should have done what they needed to do. I did my job the way I was told to do it. So, and these are the things, like I said, that, you know, there's just so many questions, you know, the white pickup truck that was out there that I told them about before I left. Nobody seemed to make any kind of, you know, nobody seemed to say anything about it. It wasn't pertinent, I guess, but I believe it was. The tractor, was on that tractor before I left.
There's a lot of questions.
I'm very passionate. You know, I want a fair trial. I do. Everybody deserves that. And I respect the court's decision, but I also want, you know, if you're going to have a fair trial, you have to ask the tough questions about, you know, those certain things, you know, gather more information, you know, as far as who was out there then. If it wasn't Paul, like I thought it was, you know, then who was out there? Who was driving that tractor before I left?
And if it's nothing of any, you know, weight, then there's nothing of any weight to it. But just getting the question answered is what needs to be done for it to be dismissed as nothing. You've talked about your belief in the past that Alex had a plan A, and that someone else was supposed to be at Moselle that night, possibly to take the fall or play a role. And then when that didn't work, he went to plan B and did it himself. Is that where you still sit today when you run this through your mind and try to figure out what the heck was going on at Moselle that night? Where do you sit today?
I believe that that one individual was, you know, alive today, because he didn't go to the property that evening. And I firmly believe that, because he was telling people, you know, how bad, you know, Paul and him were getting along, that they weren't getting along, you know, all that great, that they were having words. And I can honestly tell you that individual was not confrontational at all. He would do anything you asked him to. And he was slow. He was 63 years old. I mean, he's not going to take on a 20 something year old, you know, young man. He was not disrespectful to anybody. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I believe it saved his life that he did not come to that property that night, because that's the two gun theory that I have in my book, you know, one of the theories. And it makes a lot of sense that you have two, one to use on, you know, your son and your wife. And the other one is to you know, kill the individual that came out there at your request. That was another request that he had made for him to come out, and he didn't go out there that night. Now, as far as what you asked me about, you know, the people I call the cleaners, I do believe he had help. He most definitely had help. You know, I think he kind of messed up a little bit on that 911 call that they try to explain away during the trial. You know, is, oh, you were talking to the dispatcher or something like that. No, he was not. He was talking to whoever was there helping him clean up the scene and remove the weapons or, you know, whatever it was that they were doing. But I strongly believe that.
If there was other people there, are you surprised that by now, like, nobody has come forward and said, yeah, I did this, just to further nail it to Alec Murdaugh? Or does this go deeper? Would there be a, if they don't need a loyalty to Alec Murdaugh anymore because he's behind bars and doesn't hold any power, is there somebody else out there that's holding power? Is there somebody else that was beyond Alec that was holding power that had something to do with this? Where does these third party cleaners' loyalties lie, and why would they have not come forward at this point to say, hey, he tried to make us do this? Or maybe, like I said, maybe there's something else deeper going on here, or other things well beyond Moselle.
I think money had a lot to do with it. And I think, will they ever come forward? Probably not. Probably not, especially risking, you know, they're going to risk going to prison for Alex. Mm-hmm. I doubt it very much that they're going to come forward. It's been going on 5 years now, you know, here in the next week or so. So will they ever come forward? No. Everyone has speculated and said, I will never disclose who I believe they are. But as far as them coming forward at any time, or they mm-hmm. won't. But I believe money was behind it. And, you know, I think if investigators really wanted to look in it, all they have to do is really, really look into it and just look at the people that were around him and, you know, see what their status is now, you know. That's basically all I can say.
Yeah. I mean, his defense attorneys, Alex's defense attorneys, the other day had said that they now they believe they have leads, third parties, and potential motives is, I believe, exactly what was said. And obviously, it's the words of a defense attorney. It was Harpudlin or Griffin. I forget which one said it. But it's something that they'd want to dig into or look at closer. My thought is, okay, if you're going to dig in and look closer at that, you're probably still going to find a nexus of Alec Murdaugh here. So if there's truly a third party that has nothing to do with Alec Murdaugh, is that going to be out there? Or if someone truly did dig and was able to uncover this, are you always going to find a nexus with Alec Murdaugh being part of this equation for getting rid of Maggie and Paul, whether he's pulling the trigger or somebody else is?
I can tell you right now that they're going to try to deflect everything towards everybody else other than their client. Yeah. They're going to try to either say it was a drug deal gone bad, which is what a lot of the rumors are, or that he owed money to these people, or that, you know, it was some kids there that came in and, you know, out of revenge, you know, because Paul was going to, you know, tell on him, mm-hmm. you know, that's why he was killed. And that's all speculation. It's not something that I believe. And like I said, I'm firm within the 4 minutes from the kennel video to the time that they were murdered.
Yeah.
Those dogs would have been alerting. And I stand by that. The dogs are not alerting. There was nobody else out there when it happened.
Yeah.
So for them to talk about the people, there was two guys that were indicted for drugs or something. One thing that I do know is the majority of these guys, they're not capable of, you know, some of them are, but like I said, some of the guys that he was dealing with, I just don't believe that they could have done something as horrific as what happened that night.
A big lane that
and
I think.
Spoke to Mr.
Go ahead. You spoke to who?
Yes, sir.
You just said you spoke.
I spoke to everybody refers to him as Cousin Eddie. I ran into him at, you know, the store.
Yeah.
I saw his demeanor. I saw his interactions or whatever. And they're going to try to, you know, probably say that he had something. By no means am I saying the man's a saint, but I don't think he would be capable of doing that. You know, he said he didn't even know them. You know, he might have met Paul one time, but he said he didn't even know Maggie.
Yeah.
So, and he said it himself to me. He would have never hurt anybody like that. He said that that's just, I will never do something like that. So I just think that people have it out for him because of who he is, but he's just he was raised in the country.
Yeah.
You know, he's a country boy at heart, and some folks are rough like that, but it doesn't mean that they're bad people.
Sure. I mean, he was one where it felt like he could be an easy target for bad guy. And, and obviously you start looking a little deeper. It's like, no, just kind of a country guy. The other lane to this with the drugs that I still baffles me, baffles a lot of people, the sheer dollar amount of drugs that Alec was pulling in, enough to kill a zoo. Nowhere on any element of this planet could Alec Murdaugh consume that level of drugs and live. What the hell do you think was going on with the drugs and the amount of drugs that he was allegedly buying for that dollar amount?
They sure try to make it look like he was on that amount of drugs. I can tell you, he was functioning normal, but I do not believe that he was spending what they said he was spending on them drugs for his personal use. That is absolutely unfathomable. I cannot.
So does that lead you to believe that the dollar amount that they said he was spending on drugs is off and wrong? And for some, however this was calculated, that amount of money is not accurate to the amount he was spending on drugs? That would answer that he didn't have that many drugs. Or if he was spending that much on drugs, where were the rest of the drugs going? Or was he getting insanely ripped off on the drugs he was buying and paying way too much for not as much as that should be buying you? There's a couple choose your own adventures there.
The amount of money that he said that they said he was spending on drugs. That's too much. It does not. It's just too much. He would have been dead if he was consuming that amount of that large amount of drugs. Was he consuming drugs? Yes, he was. But was he functioning? He was functioning. You know, he was going to work, even though he was running late all the time. But, you know, he was going to work. He was still functioning. So he would have been the amount of money and spent on that enormous amount of drugs would have killed him.
Do you think the path that leads to whoever was getting him this level of drugs that would kill anybody, would kill a zoo, that path would lead us more into the direction of who some of these fixers may be or some of his help may be, these folks that are staying silent that helped Alec in whatever the hell he did here or why ever he did this? Do you think that the drugs intersect in that, or is that a totally separate lane and a total separate lane of chaos in the world of Alec Murdaugh?
I think that drugs is totally separate from the crime scene itself. It was he on drugs? Yes.
Sure.
Did those individuals have anything to do with that? Like a lot of people are trying to say that they could have, you know, they knew. First of all, they can say whatever they can, but I don't believe nobody knew that Paul, you know, he might have told a few friends or whatever, you know, that he was coming to the property. But other than that, nobody really knew. Maggie was going back and forth. You know, that night, I believe Maggie was going back to Edisto because she had work that she wanted to get done, mm-hmm. you know, in Edisto. Did they possibly have an argument before she left? I believe so, because, you know, the 27th of May was when they found the stash, I believe, something like that, or when he went to his appointment, Maggie found that stash.
Yeah.
So, that I believe was, I think that was a sore subject for Maggie, when it came to the drugs. And could it be possibly that they had a small argument or something over that, you know, or she gave him an ultimatum to get detoxed, you know, maybe. Yeah. But it's still, and then trying to make it, you know, they can say, well, it was a robbery, or they tried, you know, I think that was one of the plans that he had to try to make it look like it could have possibly been a robbery. Mm-hmm. They maybe attempted to take her ring, but why not take all of the jewelry? She was wearing a lot of, you know, her jewelry was worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
And not to include the items that were in the car that were worth a lot of money. Plus, yeah. If they were really looking at taking, you know, something of value or making it look like a robbery, you know, that they actually pulled up and intended to rob them, they would have, around here, they would have probably taken her car, mm-hmm. Taken all the stuff that was in the car, taken her jewelry and everything, and probably burned the car up somewhere out there in the woods in the middle of nowhere, yeah. Had they been, you know, people that were out to get, you know, just to rob somebody. Like they also tried to, you know, rumor was going around that somebody possibly could have tried to rob them or whatever. If they would have done that, they would have stolen the car. So
there's still, and we'll wrap on this question. There's a lot of time between now and the next Alec murder trial. No date has been set as of yet. We're probably talking at least a year before this gets into a courtroom for an actual trial date. Do you have any concerns about anything between now and then when it comes to any element of retrying Alec Murdaugh? Witnesses, statements, evidence, anything? Is there anything that you obviously know it's going back to trial that's a red flag to you going, okay, I hope this makes it, or I hope this, is there anything that's concerning to you?
The evidence convicted him. There was more than enough evidence. Another trial is just a different set of jurors that are going to be on the trial. Mm-hmm. And he really needs to think about the fact that if the death penalty is on, you know, the table this time around, the state prisons that housed the death row inmates are not the nicest ones you want to be in. So those are things he really needs to consider, whether he wants to move forward or he wants to. I worked in the prison system, so I can tell you some of them, I'm not going to name them by name because there's good people that work there. It just, you know, but he needs to think really, really hard. If it goes south on him, this is where you're going to end up with. It's not, you know, it's not a carnival in there. You know, it's real life and it's tough.
It's certainly a calculated risk he's going to have to take. If he wants to go through this again. If you could say anything to Alec right now, if you could give him a message of any sort, whatever, what would you say to him?
Just tell the truth. Stop lying. Tell the truth. I've never said once that you didn't love your wife or your son, but just tell the truth. You snapped. You needed the money. Your case was coming up. Just be honest with yourself. And just, you know, stop trying to claim that you're innocent when you're not.
Blanca Simpson, a big thank you to her for joining us and giving us her insight into what was happening in the world of Alec Murdaugh and Maggie and Paul and Buster during those critical years and moments leading up to the tragedy that took their lives. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love to hear them. Be sure to weigh in. Links are in the description. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers. And $30 coin packs are on sale for 10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hey, everybody, Lady Luck here, and we're celebrating America's 250th birthday. Now, all summer long, I'm going to be celebrating by playing on SpinQuest.com, which is an American-owned social casino. It obviously features over 1,000 slot games and live blackjack, live craps, live bubble craps. Head on over to SpinQuest.com. Get yourself a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players' $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.